But it's great.
Hello, this is Stephanie with the News Gazette, dated Friday, June 8th, 2018. We'll begin on the front page with the article headline, Vitally Important, Nursing School Grads Getting Together for One Final Reunion. They spent their professional lives taking care of others in hospitals and doctor's offices across Illinois and beyond. In retirement, they continue to give back, funding scholarships for young nursing students. Now the women who graduated from the former Julia F. Burnham School of Nursing in Champaign are holding their final alumna banquet, honoring the last five graduating classes from 1968 through 1972. This group is getting old, joked Rosemary Smith, one of six Burnham graduates organizing Saturday's banquet at the Hawthorne Suites in Champaign. I'm the youngest on the committee and I'm 74 and a half. We're talking antiques here. Tell that to Bonnie McElwee, class of 62, who still runs marathons in her 70s. The nursing school, originally part of Burnham Hospital, was a fixture in the community for decades, producing 813 nurses over its nearly 70-year run. The first graduating class, in 1907, had five graduates, as did the last, in 1972. The school closed after Parkland College opened its nursing program. The Julia F. Burnham Nurses alumna held their first annual banquet in 1913, and as far as we can tell, there was pretty much a banquet of some kind ever since then, Smith said. While many graduates stayed in Illinois, the women being honored Saturday hail from coast to coast: New York, Florida, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Kansas, Colorado, Arizona, California, and Oregon, even Hawaii. Some of the experiences we've had are just astounding, said Charlotte Golden, a 1960 graduate and longtime nurse at Burnham, who retired in 2005. Burnham Hospital, which stood at 310 East Springfield Avenue, opened in 1895, spearheaded by Albert C. Burnham and his wife, Julia F. Burnham, who died the year before it was completed, according to the University of Illinois Archives. The nursing school opened a few years later. In 1924, voters approved the hospital's purchase, and it became Burnham City Hospital. Covenant Medical Center, formerly Mercy Hospital, bought the building from the city of Champaign in 1989 and closed it in 1992. The Burnham building was later demolished, and the site is now a high-rise apartment building, Burnham 310, and a county market store. The nursing school was housed in a building on the west side of 3rd Street, across from the hospital. Students lived there and attended classes in the basement and learned medical procedures at the hospital, said Smith, who graduated in 1964. The rules in the dorm were strict, with a watchful house mother at the end of the hall, but we had a good time, Smith said. We were pretty close. Students came from Champaign-Urbana, as well as surrounding towns. Coursework could be tough, and students had to maintain high grades. Classes that started out with 30 women might end up with 17 graduates, Smith said. There were times you'd come off duty from nights and go to class, and you felt like you were dead on your feet, she said. Life was different for women then. Nursing students were prohibited from getting married until the last 6 months of their 3-year program, in case they got pregnant. We used to stand up when a doctor walked into the room. Now the nurses are kind of on a par with physicians, said Carolyn Hamrick, a 1956 graduate. Even though some of the instructors were from the University of Illinois, nursing students weren't allowed to go on campus, though some of them did anyway. One thing I remember was that we all went to Green Street, Smith said. Study hours were 7 to 10, and the first person to break would call Steak and Shake. Two of us would go down to order in our pajamas. It wasn't easy, but it was a fun time. I enjoyed it immensely. I think everybody pretty much enjoyed it, she said. Many of the women have gone on to earn bachelor's and master's degrees, and even one PhD, landing jobs in critical care, management, and other roles. Donna Stanner, class of 58, received her master's from Indiana University's nursing school, and worked as a nursing director at Mercy and later director of home health care at Lakeview Hospital in Danville, later United Samaritans and now OSF Healthcare Sacred Heart Medical Center. The 50-year honorees are asked to send in a letter about what they've accomplished in life, and every one of them has said how much the Burnham School of Nursing meant to them and how it prepared them for anything, Stanner said. The alumna group launched a scholarship program in 1995 and has awarded 38 since then, ranging from $250 to $1,500 a semester, according to Stanner, the committee chairwoman. Recipients must attend nursing school in Illinois or have some tie to one of the Burnham graduates. Winners have included their daughters, granddaughters, and nieces. The awards are funded by the graduates themselves through gifts, memorial donations, and bequests. One alumna left half of her insurance policy to the scholarship fund, Stanner said. They enjoy continuing their legacy by contributing to the education of future nurses, Stanner said. Smith said the group will continue the scholarship program as long as we still have money. More than 100 alumnae and guests are expected to the final banquet Saturday, including several longtime area doctors. Members plan to continue meeting and hosting an occasional reunion in years to come. The group has been an important bond for the graduates over the years. It's amazing to me we've been able to keep it up as long as we have, said Hamrick, a longtime obstetrics gynecology nurse at Burnham and Carl, who retired in 2001. They're also pleased that the original terracotta sign for Julia F. Burnham Hospital, which hung above the north entrance off Stoughton Avenue, was recently placed in a historical marker at University and Romine Avenues in Urbana, in front of what is now OSF Healthcare, Heart of Mary Medical Center, formerly Mercy, Provena, Presence, Covenant. Julia F. Burnham's name lives on, Hamrick said. Next on the front page, we have an article headlined, Moving Pieces, PNC Bank files notice it wants to relocate to Midtown. PNC Bank may leave its three-decade home downtown for the new Midtown Plaza, a half-mile closer to campus, which would open up a large space in the historic building that once housed First National Bank. PNC posted a legal notice in Thursday's News Gazette asking the Federal Office of the Comptroller of the Currency for permission to relocate a domestic branch from 30 East Main Street to 302 South First Street. PNC spokeswoman Marcy Zweibel said it was too early to provide details beyond that the bank is considering its options regarding a potential relocation. But Dan Hamelberg, the developer of the Midtown Plaza across from the Boneyard Creek Retention Pond, said PNC is planning to move there. As long as they put the notice in, it's okay to share, he said. I would suspect that they will be operational by the end of the year. PNC is expected to use about two-thirds of the Midtown Plaza's north building, Hamelberg said. Midtown is going to be an interesting development for years to come, and they're getting in on the ground floor, he said. Plus, their location between downtown and campus gives them the ability to service both types of people. If the move to Midtown happens, it's unclear what would replace PNC in the pillared building, which is owned by PNC and also houses the law firm Thomas, Mamer & Howie. That's the first I heard of that, said attorney Bruce Warren, managing partner at TM&H. We've been in the building since 1946, at the time renting three rooms. Now we rent 3.5 floors, so we'd be very concerned about what the future's going to be. Of course, we want to stay there. PNC, which has 5 branches in Champaign-Urbana, has owned the downtown building since around 1990. It was built in the 1850s as First National Bank, according to city historian Dan McCollum, Champaign's mayor from 1987 to 1999. I love that building. It was built on a level of pretentiousness that was utterly astonishing, he said. It was the Harris family that was the original main investors in that bank. B.F. Harris was probably Champaign County's first mega-rich individual. The building used to have a magnificent lobby that was shortened in the 1980s to add another floor, McCollum said. I was so offended by the loss of the lobby that I moved my account and safety deposit box, he said. It's certainly the most extraordinary bank building ever erected in Champaign County. Hamelberg also announced Thursday some good news for taco lovers. Fernando's food truck plans to open a brick-and-mortar location in the Midtown Plaza, hopefully by the end of July, while still operating the truck. I was looking for another opportunity for people to have a place to sit, especially during the wintertime, said the truck's namesake, Fernando Leonor. The restaurant will have the same menu, with perhaps a couple additions, Leonor said, and will be open late at night, much like the food truck. Leonor said he wasn't planning to open a physical location when he started the food truck almost 2 years ago. It was not in my mind, but we had the opportunity, he said. Also, we opened a chance for people to get a job, because a lot of people ask me if they can work for me. They'll join PNC in the plaza's north building, Hamelberg said, along with an exercise area for residents. There's one spot left on the southeast corner of the building, he said. He couldn't comment yet on who might be coming to the south building. Things are moving right along. Starting June 1st, we started moving people in. Just about all the units are rented, Hamelberg said. I would call it an oasis in Champaign. Being in Midtown, adjacent to the retention basin, which is like a city park, gave us a bit of an edge. The views are extraordinary, whether looking over the basin or downtown. Our last story on the front page is headlined, Concussion Bill Awaits Governor's Signature. It would mandate statewide rules for schools to follow. Governor Bruce Rauner has on his desk a bill that would set up standardized protocols statewide on if, when, and how a student should return to a sport after sustaining a concussion. The bill, unanimously passed in the Senate in April and the House in May, is the brainchild of two Naperville high school students and was sponsored by State Rep. Stephanie Kifowit, Democrat of Oswego. The governor's office Thursday was not yet willing to say if he plans to sign the bill, but if it becomes law, it would have the Illinois State Board of Education adopt specific rules and protocols on how best to accommodate a student who may have sustained a concussion during an interscholastic athletic activity. It would also ask the Illinois Department of Public Health to write up educational brochures on concussions, listing warning signs and other general information to be distributed to any student who may have sustained a concussion, whether at an interscholastic athletic event or otherwise. The bill notes that concussions are one of the most commonly reported injuries in children and adolescents who participate in sports. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it cites, estimates that as many as 3.9 million sports-related concussions happen every year in the United States. At Mahomet Seymour High School, head coach Keith Pogue said he deals with one or two concussions a year in football. "When people continue to do things with concussions, that's where we see trouble," Pogue said. "So my big concern is making sure they don't practice or play when they have symptoms." It's imperative, Pogue said, to have clearance from a physician before a student gets back on the field to do any kind of activity. When a student is diagnosed with a concussion, Pogue said that he tries to keep the student in a dark, non-stimulating environment until they're symptom-free. Only after about three symptomless days can a student come back to do light exercises for about a week. He added that he thinks some of what's in the bill might end up being redundant, since many school districts already have similar strict protocols in place. For example, schools already have to keep on file sign-off forms that notify athletes and their parents about the dangers of concussions and head injuries, a measure signed into law in 2011 by then-Governor Pat Quinn. Each school can produce its own form, but it has to be approved by the Illinois High School Association. However, Kifowit, the bill's House sponsor, said too many districts have adopted protocols that don't go far enough. That's why it's important, she said, to mandate uniform rules across the state. "What we found is that different districts had different standards and protocols," she said. "The overall focus is that things need to be uniform across the state. One school district may appropriately follow the law and has those protocols, but others might not." There are certain requirements set out in the bill for students undergoing concussion treatment, addressing when they return to play and return to learn. What Kifowit said she had found is that too often coaches prioritize getting their players back on the field, but don't pay as much attention to returning to learn protocols. The bill, she said, would give equal time to both. "With kids, we have to realize that their brain is still developing," said former Illini football player and brain injury researcher Kevin Jackson. "My biggest concern is the long-term complications that come from repetitive head hits." He said recovery time from a concussion differs from person to person. "It's hard to pinpoint what's going on, what the underlying factors are, and how long the brain needs to recover," Jackson said. It's the focus on football that Jackson said also contributes to many of the misconceptions around head injuries. Swimmers, soccer players, and hockey players are just as likely to sustain some sort of head injury. He also stressed the importance of patience. Often, he said, coaches want their players back on the field as quickly as possible. With just 8 or 9 games a season, coaches, Jackson said, are often frustrated with having to keep a player off the field for longer than a week or two. "But as a parent, I want my kid to be healthy long-term, so I really can't look at it from the short-term like they do," he said. "It's about whether my kid will be able to play if he goes to college or plays longer than that. Pulling them out 2 weeks is better than long-term consequences." Let's move now to the local section, where we will start with Jim Day's column headlined, "The Sleight of Hand Budget Balance." They say, and the machinations of the General Assembly over the past 3 years demonstrate, that it's difficult to pass a balanced budget for the state of Illinois. But it's no problem that a little hocus-pocus can't easily resolve, as shown by the $38.5 billion budget passed overwhelmingly by members of the Illinois House and Senate and signed into law this week by Governor Bruce Rauner. "This was a great team effort, a great bipartisan effort," Rauner said. This year's kumbaya budget moment stands in stark contrast to the bitter budget wars that marked the 2-year-plus standoff between Rauner, a Republican, and House Speaker Michael Madigan, a Democrat. It's unclear exactly why the D's and the R's decided to play ball this time, but it seems obvious they decided to get along so they could avoid the risk that a budget backlash would blow up in either party's face in November. So they passed a budget that they say is balanced, but really isn't. Since most people don't pay any attention, it's easy to pull the wool over voters' eyes. Illinois will continue to spend more money than it takes in, continue not to pay its bills on time, and continue to expend disproportionate amounts of its revenues on pensions at the expense of core services. Observing the budget sleight of hand from a distance, the Standard & Poor's bond rating agency reaffirmed the state's credit rating as one notch above junk status at BBB-. That, the agency said, is the lowest possible rating within the investment grade categories. Among the state's leading credit risks are its fiscal structure, which in our view remains out of balance, a still elevated unpaid bill backlog, absence of a budget reserve, and distressed pension funding levels. While the emergence of a more collaborative budget process has potentially constructive credit implications, the substance of the package largely represents an extension of the status quo, according to Standard & Poor's. In other words, Illinois is just doing more of what it created its unprecedented budget woes. Although required by the Illinois Constitution to pass a balanced budget, it's been roughly 20 years since the General Assembly has done so. That raises the question, how does the legislature evade a constitutional mandate? That's where the hocus pocus comes in. Approving a state budget, which is most certainly a complicated business, requires making assumptions about revenue and expenditures. So the legislature makes assumptions about receiving revenue that, in reality, the state will not receive. The most glaring example of that ploy is the Thompson Center in Chicago. The state wants to rid itself of this albatross, but Rauner and the Democrats haven't been able to work out the terms. What they have been able to do for three straight years is include in the budget $300 million they might get if the state actually sells the Thompson Center. Over the past 3 years, the state has budgeted $900 million in revenue for the so far non-sale of the building. That's what is known as active hocus-pocus. There's also passive hocus-pocus, actions that legislators specifically do not take because it would immensely complicate the budget-making process. That's why Democrats refuse to approve a revenue estimate to guide their spending decisions. Revenue estimates matter because it's difficult to decide how much to spend without knowing how much is available to spend. The state's Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability estimated the state will receive $37.8 billion in revenue. The governor's budget office estimated about $100 million more, almost $38 billion. Legislative Democrats rejected Republican suggestions that they, too, make a revenue estimate, but the Democrats repeatedly refused, so they would not have to live within the constraints a revenue estimate would impose. Then they all approved a $38.5 billion spending plan that exceeded both revenue estimates and was balanced by means of budget gimmickry. That includes $800 million in fund sweeps, borrowing from special state funds that probably will not be repaid, and estimated savings of $444 million in pension costs generated by pension buyouts that are almost certainly exaggerated. The budgeteers also ignored a liability of up to $400 million in back pay owed to state workers as a consequence of a court decision. Exaggerate on the credit side, ignore on the debit side, throw in a little hocus pocus plus a dollop of flim flam. Presto changeo, the budget is balanced on paper, certainly not in reality. Then all the cooks who spoiled the broth congratulate themselves on pulling another fast one on the public and hit the campaign trail for re-election. This week's Clergy Corner feature is headlined Pastor to Bid Farewell to Campus Town Church. More than a decade after he became Twin City Bible Church's senior pastor, the Reverend Shannon Coffey is trusting in God about the next chapter in his life. Coffey is leaving the Campus Town Church at the end of the month. He'll be preaching there for the last time June 17th. Coffey resigned without another job lined up, but he and his wife prayed about this decision and felt God was guiding them to wrap up their time at Twin City Bible, he said. Whether they remain in the local community will depend on his next job. It's one of the great adventures of faith, he said. Coffey, 48, has a long history at Twin City Bible, where he first started coming in the late 1980s as a UI freshman. After divinity school, he returned for an internship and joined the staff as an associate pastor in 2000. 7 years later, he was named senior pastor. It's been a privilege, he said. Married to his college sweetheart, the father of three children grew up in the Chenoa Pontiac area in a family in which his faith was nurtured. He was a business major at the U of I, but began sensing a call to the ministry during his college years. After graduating, he worked for a couple of years, including a stint on the management track with Menards. He enrolled in Trinity Evangelical Divinity School after he and his wife, Kathy, spent 2 years as missionaries in Swaziland, Africa. Many of Twin City Bible's regular members are college students, though it's a church that connects with and serves people of all generations, Coffey said. Maybe we don't have the greatest parking, but they get a chance to connect with college students who love Jesus, he said. Twin City Bible will be bringing in an interim pastor candidate this weekend. Coffey remains excited about its future in a community he says has a lot of great churches. This is really a great community to grow your faith, he said. And here's a box that has some key dates in Twin City Bible church history. 1933, founding families established the church with a mission of extending the Christian message to UI students. 1960, the church settled in its building at 806 West Michigan. And in 2012, the church extended its mission west of campus with a second location, TCBC Midtown at 24 East Green Street C. Our next local story is headlined Suspect Acquitted of Murder, but Man Guilty of Mob Action. This story is Dateline Danville. A 24-year-old Danville man could soon walk out of the Vermilion County Jail after spending a little more than a year behind bars in connection with the May 30, 2017 stabbing death of Curran Kimmins. A jury of 7 men and 5 women deliberated for about 2 hours Thursday afternoon before acquitting Ronald R. Pettis of first-degree murder. It did, however, find Pettis guilty of the lesser charge of mob action. Vermilion County Circuit Judge Nancy Fahey could sentence Pettis to probation or 1 to 6 years in prison for that Class 4 offense at his July 19th hearing. After the verdicts were read, Fahey granted a motion by Sandy Lawless, Pettis's attorney, to reduce her client's bond from $1 million to $10,000 in this case and a separate residential burglary case, meaning he would have to post $1,000 in order to be released. Pettis turned to Lawless and gave her a small smile when the judge announced the not guilty verdict, then hugged her after the jury left. Lawless said she was pleased with that verdict, although we certainly would have liked him to be found not guilty of mob action, she said, still maintaining his innocence. State's Attorney Jacqueline Lacey said she respected the jury's decisions. However, she added, we believe the evidence supported felony murder. Pettis was the first of 4 people to be tried in connection with Mr. Kimmins' death. According to testimony from Dr. Scott Denton, the forensic pathologist who conducted the autopsy, Mr. Kimmins died of a stab wound which punctured his aorta. Pettis's younger sister, Malika Anthony, now 16, faces 5 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of mob action. Prosecutors allege that Anthony, who was 15 at the time of the murder, actually stabbed the victim. Their older sister, Renisha E. Pettis, 26, and Marcus D. Jefferson, 24, each face 1 count each of first-degree murder, aggravated battery, and mob action. Their jury trials are all scheduled for July 16th. During his closing argument, Assistant State's Attorney Ivo Austin argued that Pettis, his sisters, and others descended upon Lushan Clark at her apartment in the 900 block of Campbell Lane as the Memorial Day weekend was ending. They were acting as a mob to do violence to Lushan Clark and her family, Austin said, reminding them of Clark's testimony that her teenage daughter Chantel and Anthony had fought the previous Friday. He also replayed a few seconds of video from a Fair Oaks security camera showing 7 people approach Clark as Luther Tate, her current boyfriend, Mr. Kimmins, her former boyfriend of 8 years, and her son Chauncey stood nearby. The first thing, the defendant takes off his jacket, Austin said. That's the universal sign, I'm ready to fight. As Renisha Pettis runs toward Clark, grabs her and throws her down, Austin said Pettis is shown balling his fists. He's squaring up, looking for someone to fight, because that's what the group had come to do, he argued. Austin pointed out that as others get involved, Mr. Kimmins is seen pulling on Renisha to get her off of Lushan. That's when the defendant strikes Curran Kimmins. Curran Kimmins doubles over, and Malika Anthony stabs him in the back with a knife. In her rebuttal, Lacey said that although Anthony clearly stabbed Mr. Kimmins, Pettis bore some accountability for his death because he was part of the angry group of people who came to attack Clark and were seen attacking her and her family members and friends. They came for a fight. They were there for revenge. They were angry, Lacey said. However, Lawless argued the only evidence prosecutors presented was testimony from Clark, her daughter Chantel, and her son Chauncey, who had an axe to grind with the Pettis girls. She also argued that on that night, Pettis could not have known Renisha was going to attack Clark, or that Malika would stab Mr. Kimmins. As far as he knows, he was just walking with that group, Lawless said. Lawless went on to point out Anthony was clearly the stabber. He didn't know she was going to do that, she said, adding he didn't even know she was carrying a knife. All Ronald did was get two grown men off of his sister. That's not even mob action. Next in local news, we have places to be, things to see. These are this weekend's recommended stops, courtesy of staff writer Tim Mitchell. The first is Spitting Image. Folks line up to spit crickets at 11 a.m. Saturday at the Old Glory Festival in Bement. Organizer Pat Hunter says participants pop crickets in their mouths and spit, trying to break the record of 32 feet. Next, On the Right Track. At the 401 in Steam event Saturday and Sunday at the Monticello Railway Museum, guests will get a chance to ride a 1907 steam locomotive that came from an asphalt gravel quarry in Alabama. Feats of Strength. See John Beatty, the amazing strongman from Pasotum and NBC's America's Got Talent, bend nails, break chains, and roll frying pans at 3 p.m. Saturday at the Champaign Public Library. They've Gone Country. If you have a hankering for the country crooning of Marvin Lee, he'll be on stage at 5:30 p.m. Saturday as the star of the Melvin Music Show in the Melvin Community Hall, 108 East Main Street. Eyes on the Sky. Greg Smith of the Central Illinois Aerospace Model Rocket Club says between 24 and 50 model rockets will soar into the sky between 1 and 6 p.m. Saturday at Dodds Park. Ready, Set, Rego. Rebecca Rego and the Trainmen's first album in 2014 was called Tolano. Now they take on Monticello, performing at Allerton Park at 6 p.m. Friday. String Theory. The Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana present at 7:30 p.m. Sunday at St. John's Catholic Chapel. As they say in Beauty and the Beast, if it's not Baroque, don't fix it. All suited up. The Firebox Bluegrass Band wears suits and ties just as they would have done in Bill Monroe's Bluegrass Boys. You can see them Saturday evening at Courthouse Rocks in downtown Monticello. Under the Sea. Boys and girls can enjoy The Little Mermaid from the comfort of the Crystal Lake Park Aquatic Center at 8:30 p.m. Sunday, $6 for residents, $9 for non-residents. Ariel gets in free. And then we have Taking to the Streets. The Josephines, an alternative country band from Bowling Green, Kentucky, will be the featured performers at Saturday's Champaign Park District's Street Fest. They take to the stage at 10:30 p.m. in downtown Champaign. And one last item before we take our break. This is headlined Recorder, Clerk, Merger on Agenda. Dateline Urbana. The Champaign County Board could ask voters whether they think the county recorder's office should be rolled into the county clerk's office. It's an idea that has cropped up from time to time among county officials. At a Tuesday study session, the board is scheduled to vote on a resolution to place a binding question on the November ballot, asking voters if they support the change. If so, according to the wording of the question, the office would be eliminated by December 2020. Board member Geraldo Rosales said fellow Democrat Shana Jo Cruz proposed the board take up the issue. Rosales said he and board chairman C. Pius Weibel, also a Democrat, concurred, allowing the item to be placed on the agenda. Cruz could not be reached for comment Thursday. Oh, and here's one more item. Identity thief gets prison for violating probation. A 51-year-old fisherman who failed to live up to the terms of his probation for stealing another person's identity is headed to prison. Judge Heidi Ladd on Wednesday resentenced Michael E. Brock to 5.5 years behind bars after having found in April that he violated his probation by failing to report to an officer, get a substance abuse evaluation, or provide a current address. In September, Brock was sentenced to 4 years of probation with drug treatment after he pleaded guilty to using a relative's personal information to get credit at K Jewelers at Marketplace Mall. He then used the credit to buy about $4,000 worth of jewelry. The actual identity theft happened on June 20th, 2017. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette for June 8th in a moment. Please stay tuned.